Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. Coming up later, PC World's Steve Fox weighs in on the Carrier IQ, a service that can track almost everything you do on your smartphone and everywhere you go with it. And then Geek.com's Russell Holly answers your questions about antivirus software. Right now, we welcome a pair of Central Ohio women who have developed an app for iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPad to help people with memory loss or developmental disabilities live more independently. The name of their company is QU, as in C-U-E. U-Y-O-U. Sally Larimer first thought of the concept from her work with people who are deaf and more recently assisting older people. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Well, thank you very much.
And also with us, Jane Bardwell. She's worked in marketing, communications, consulting, and strategic planning for the past 14 years, and she's working with Sally on this application. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you for having us.
Listeners, if you have a question along the way, get them in quick because they will only be with us till about 20 after the hour. So 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So QU, you've told us that this QU app is technology for people who don't use technology. What do you mean by that, Jane?
Well, the idea that came about for QU was the fact that so many people, elderly people, aging baby boomers, are losing the ability to remember simple things of daily living. And QU is an app that is what we're calling a two-tiered app. So the adult child of an aging parent can go online to the QU website and can create a very customizable slate of messages and reminders for a loved one. And we've set it up so that the messages and reminders are automatically delivered to an iOS device, which is the iPhone, the iPod, or the iPad. And there's very, very little interaction necessary on the part of the recipient to receive and act on these messages.
And the idea being that you want to help your parent or the person that you're taking care of be more independent. Can you give us an example, Sally, of when this would be used, how it would be used?
Well, actually, it's very interesting because when I first thought of QU, it was because I was helping out an elderly woman who was 97, and she was in pretty good shape, but she had some heart issues, and she wasn't consistently taking a specific medicine. So I would go and into her house, and there would be leftover pills. And this wasn't, you know, getting resolved. She wasn't doing what she was supposed to do. So I brought in an automatic pill device. Mm-hmm. And she looked at it, and she said, "That's a child's toy. Get it out of my house." And I thought, what would make her want to be engaged in this? You know, what would make her want to take her pills, entice her a little bit? And so I thought of QU, so that this app will not just be a pill reminder, but it will be something else and beyond that, that will reward people with a nice picture or some kind of something they enjoy, mm-hmm, to get them engaged.
So give me an example. Your friend is, it's time to take her pill.
So it's time to take her pill, and she's wearing the iOS device. And she hears a little bit of a ring, and she looks down, and she says, "Time for your pill, Elizabeth." And she presses it, and she has a beautiful picture of some flowers in the springtime. She loved flowers, and that will be an immediate thank you to her for doing what, you know, we were trying to get her to do.
I love this idea, maybe for my mom, but my mom also doesn't hear very well.
Right.
Any ideas on that score? Sally, you're nodding? Or Jane?
Well, we've tried to take into account lots of different kinds of contingencies for elderly people and developmentally disabled and even people with mental illness who are integrating into the regular community. And for a person who's hard of hearing, as I said earlier, the app is customizable. So the app can be a text message. You can create a text message with an image. You can create a video and send that. You can do your own voice recording. And the alert can be either a vibration or a ringtone. So in the case of a person who is hard of hearing, the most likely representative of the message would be a text message in adjustable type size, so that if a person has difficulty seeing, that's adjustable on the part of the person scheduling the message. And the alert would come through as a vibration rather than a ringtone.
My guests are Jean Bardwell and also Sally Larimer. They're partners in a company. It's called QU Limited, and they have developed an application for the iPhone, iPod, iPad, intended to aid people with memory loss and people who are developmentally disabled. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. An interesting thing, Sally, when you and I were talking about it, that I thought was interesting as far as, I suppose it could be the case for anybody that just needs it, is it's not just about alerting you to take a pill. It can also tell you where to go next in your day. Okay, you finished your job bussing tables at the local restaurant. Now it's time to go to the library and meet your tutor.
Oh, yes. It's absolutely any message or reminder that you want
maps.
To give yourself. Maps, it can be your schedule. It can be that you have to prepare for a dentist appointment, you know, take your aspirin or whatever you have to have before you go. It really is for anybody. And I've had a lot of people tell me they could use it.
they're not just people who have memory, quote-unquote, memory
loss.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
Well, and there's another feature, if I can just say one little thing. Sally and I have talked about the fact that we don't want this to be a burdensome, tiring thing that is difficult for
more
people.
Work.
Oh, more work. Mm-hmm. So we have added in a feature that allows you to schedule in the joke of the day from a list of very clean jokes, or an inspirational message of the day, or a famous quote that you can schedule to appear randomly, just as a little something to brighten someone's day.
What were the challenges to putting this together, Sally?
Oh, wow. For me, it was
the biggest challenge.
How many challenges do you want to hear? No, it was really that I didn't know anything about creating technology, you know, I or software. I had this idea. I thought it had a really good future. But I was lucky enough to run into Janie and Kroger one day, and we started talking. And at that point, I was writing an NIH grant for this. And I got pretty good response from the NIH, but they are very slow. And so Janie and I started talking, and it really developed into an app. It was going to be a bracelet initially. That's a very expensive thing to try to produce. So it developed into an app. And the challenging part for me has been learning what the software is and how it interacts with different components and that kind of thing.
How many different variations on a theme? In other words, how do you know that the special needs person will pay attention to the Apple device? You mentioned there'd be a reward of a photograph or maybe mm-hmm. music. Or mm-hmm. I don't know to what extent. I imagine it's multimedia.
Uh-huh, yes.
But it can be very customized to.
Well, it can be very customized mm-hmm. and it can be very compelling. In fact, it can be fun. And that's what I would say. You know, if someone says, gee, my grandmother hates technology, she doesn't want to have anything to do with an iPhone. Well, if you would take it to her and wear it yourself and show her that the messages that come in are right on the front. She doesn't have to have a password. She doesn't have to go into a website. She just pushes a little button. That says I've gotten this, I've read this,
which is a key
right.
component.
It's a little, so yeah, it's it. But the message shows up on, mm-hmm. you know, with nothing on the part of the
no
reader,
prompt.
No
yeah.
prompt, and it shows up, and the individual then you know reads that, but then gets a little reward for it. And every message does not have to be a reminder of something medical that they're supposed to do and that they don't really want to hear about.
Couldn't it be just a, how are you doing today?
Yeah, how
are
you doing?
A daily
I love
thing,
you.
And then you, yeah. Then they just respond that they got the message. You know your mother or your father or whoever is okay still. And
the important thing, I think, for this is that it's also an emotional, has an emotional component in that you keep a better connection with your family and friends by doing this. And in other words, if grandma has a grandson who just scored a great goal in soccer at the high school game, then mom on her iPhone can take that video and send it over in the next day or so and say, hey, grandma, look, here's, you know, we were at the game and this is what we saw. So this can keep them very much more connected with their family and avert depression, which is very big. There are a lot of very depressed older people because of their isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of things. Sally has referred to a couple of times to the fact that you just wear this, and most people, I think, don't think of wearing an iPhone or an iPod Touch. But there are very inexpensive necklace-type components that are available, made of silicone, and some are more jewelry-like, that are actually cases for the devices that you can wear around your neck. And so for a woman in particular, that would be good. Men can wear belt holsters. Women mm-hmm. can too, but oftentimes don't. And that way the device is with the person at all times, so it makes it much more easy. And another little point is the fact that to receive and acknowledge a message, the recipient really doesn't have to do anything other than be able to swipe the screen or touch the screen on the iPhone or iPod Touch or iPad. It's that simple. I early on had a person I was speaking to say that this would never work for his 93-year-old mother because she can hardly use a TV remote. Well, this is so much more simple than
If she can actually use a TV remote, this will be very easy to use. Though.
Even if she can't, it's very easy.
Who are you marketing it to? I mean, I know that it's in development, or it's
going into beta testing.
Going into beta testing mm-hmm. now. When will it become available? And who are you? How are you getting it out there? Because it's a big world of apps now. How do you stand out?
It is, but we are trying to market to. Not only individuals who would love to give this to a family member, but to bigger groups like the developmental disabilities world.
Like assisted living facilities?
Well, even in-home care.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Because
group homes, that kind of thing?
Well, group homes, in-home care, people who still have some independence okay. and would like to keep it. That's really – or, you know, I also thought of it as, say, a vet who needs some rehabilitation for an injury could be sent home with a QU with the video of the proper way to do a rehab exercise. And that person could then be reminded when he needs or she needs to do the exercise and the best way to do it.
And there could be tutorials attached to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well – Sally Larimer and Jane Bardwell, thanks for joining us, Jane.
Thank you very much. It was nice to be here.
And Sally Larimer, thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
In.
We appreciate the time. Thanks.
Sally Larimer and Jane Bardwell, they're partners in a company. It's called QU Limited, and they're developing technology for people who have memory loss and developmental disabilities, that sort of thing. And if you want to learn more about it, they can go to
our website, www.QULTD.com.
QUYOULTD.com.
That's correct.
We'll post that website on our website as well at WOSU.org/allsides. And when we return, Steve Fox from PC World will be with us. So stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And this Friday, December 9th at 5 p.m., WOSU Public Media will no longer broadcast on 8:20 a.m. To hear national news from NPR and local news from our award-winning news team, tune to 89.7 FM. On 89.7 NPR News, you can hear your favorite shows, like All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can also stream 89.7 on your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org and be sure to set your radio dial to 89.7 FM after this Friday, December 9th. 40 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today, a high of 44. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 31 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 42. Partly cloudy skies Wednesday night, a low of 27. And sunshine looking ahead to Thursday, a high of 37 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
A hot topic on the internet right now is Carrier IQ's diagnostic software that has come installed on more than 150 million mobile devices around the world. Last month, security researcher Trevor Eckert charged that Carrier IQ's software secretly tracks every move on your mobile phone. Carrier IQ denies wrongdoing and says its technology is only used to improve handset performance and network quality. Joining us now to talk about tracking software is PC World Vice President and Editorial Director Steve Fox. Welcome back, Steve.
It's great to be here.
First of all, what is Carrier IQ software, and why did Trevor Eckert post a video to YouTube asserting that it's hidden but operating on his Android?
Well, this is a great story in terms of being really interesting and brings up sort of an inherent conflict that we have about, I'd say, our relationship with technology, right? Because we want great service from, say, our mobile phones or devices. We want our phones to know everything that we want. We want it to pretty much do it for us, but we also want privacy. We don't want anyone snooping, right? Those are, you know, reasonable expectations. There's a little piece of software called Carrier IQ that is put onto mobile devices that is capable of essentially listening to what you do, tracking various things, and there's some disagreement about exactly what it does track. And it has a purpose, right? The idea of Carrier IQ, and it's put on by the carriers, those are your providers, you know, your Verizons, your AT&T, T-Mobile, and the like. They want to know when calls are dropped. They want to know how you are using your device. They want to improve the battery life on cell phones. So for that to happen, they need to know what it is that you're doing on the phone. So they use this software to get this information. Of course, in getting that information, they know sort of potentially a lot about you.
So this has just come to light. Is
yeah.
Trevor Eckert
yeah.
the one that's unleashed the questioning minds on it?
Right. I mean, the interesting thing about this is not so much that it exists. You know, think about, let's say, antivirus software in your computer. You expect that to look at absolutely everything that you do, and it's going to be looking at things that are happening and taking appropriate action. But there we're making a decision. I'm going to put this onto my computer, and I'll be safe because of it. Here, this thing was pretty much hidden. If you're on, say, an Android phone that has it, and it's on, you know, something like 150 million devices, that's Android, on BlackBerry, even on iPhones, you're not going to see this thing showing up as an application that you're running. Mm-hmm. If you really know what you're doing, you can kind of dig deep, like some of these researchers did, and they see this little stub, this piece of software. But it's not something you choose to put on there. And so this came to light, and this researcher asked the question, what exactly is this thing doing? And as he dug deeper, he realized this is a listening post or something. It's really about performance monitoring, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in so doing, it will be secretly logging things that, you know, potentially even every button that you push. So even though it's diagnostic software, it's really acting like malware, like a virus. And it has what's called privileged access. It looks, you know, relatively deep into the operating system of your phone, because phones are just like other computing devices have an operating system. It has access to sort of the deepest levels of the phone, so it can know a lot about what's going on and what you're doing.
So when you talk about this privileged access, is it something that you can choose to deactivate if you want?
On the iPhone, for instance, there are some settings that you can change, and we've got some of that information online.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, this is not obvious. Somewhere at the beginning when you're installing, say, iOS 5, you have a point where you can say, hit a button that says, yes, I want to share the information so that, my carrier can do good things and give me better service. If you don't check that, it won't run Carrier IQ, and you can then later go through and deactivate it, but it's really not easy. On Android phones, much harder, to actually deactivate this.
To what extent are all the mobile phone companies, because it's the mobile phone companies that are using this. This is what they use to say, we have 20% fewer dropped calls and
blah, blah.
That's how they're doing it.
Exactly. So if you're looking for an evil player here, and I actually don't think there are evil players, but if you're looking for someone with some culpability here, it's the carriers themselves, the mobile phone companies, that are putting this, that are choosing to put this onto the phones so that they can get more information. And again, as you said, it's about providing for them, providing better service. However, in providing better service, there's potential, and I think that's the question here. There is potential for something, you know, somewhat frightening, because you've got all this information about people. I actually don't believe that these companies are holding all this information and are doing nefarious things with it. But in fact, the folks who decide what information they get and they keep and what they do with it, that's based on carrier to carrier. It's based on the company itself. So, in other words, Carrier IQ will tell you, you know, we're just making the tools, and it's the users who will decide what to do with it. The users, in this case, being the carriers. It looks like, from what we've seen at this point, the software itself, it can record keystrokes, you know, in terms of what you're dialing. But it can't record any other keystrokes, is what we're told on a phone. It can tell where you are, your location, your GPS data. It can read web addresses, is what we've seen, but not necessarily what's on those web pages. Of course, if you have a web address, it's not that big of a stretch to say, well, you could go to that address and see what it is. So, what do the carriers do with this information? It's what's good about what this coming to light is that people are asking these questions. You actually even have some, you know, congressional folks getting involved, or actually I think it was maybe it's even the Senate is asking some questions about this. And these are the questions that need to be asked, and you know, someone needs to be held accountable for this, because as I said, we want great service, but we also want our privacy.
Is this a sort of thing it could potentially know what books you download from Amazon to your iPad?
This is something like a whodunit. It's a little bit of a mystery here, because what you're trying to do, as researchers are going in, they're trying to figure out what this software does, and it's not that easy. So, yeah, potentially, and I can't say that it absolutely does, but potentially it could determine what you're downloading and what you're viewing online. Then again, we already have that information, or rather, somebody has that information. If you go to Amazon,
This would aggregate everything you do.
Right, and there's the idea is that this is not information that we have in general chosen to give to the carriers.
Mm-hmm.
We make decisions based upon trust every single day. If you trust Amazon, okay, you'll download from them. You know, trust them as in trust them not to do untoward things with your data and the information about you. Same with Google. Google knows huge amounts potentially about you, because every time you put something into that search bar and ask for something, you know, that's information that clearly is running through its servers. But there is a certain degree of our choice. And this thing, we didn't even know about it. Right? Here it is. It's lurking on our phones. We thought of these as, you know, almost like, you know, dumb terminals that allow us to do things. But actually, there's information that's flowing back and forth. And here's a piece of software that potentially can know what that is.
My guest is Steve Fox, editorial director at PC World. We're talking about the Carrier IQ's diagnostic software. It comes installed on more than 150 million mobile devices around the world. If you have a question or comment for Steve Fox, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go onto the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We're talking about Carrier IQ's diagnostic software. It's probably on your iPhone. Some people are blaming Carrier IQ for the problem. Others, you know, as we mentioned earlier, blaming the mobile phone companies. And then you were talking about research. Researchers really don't know the depth, the breadth, and the depth of the information that could be gathered from this. Why is it so hard to figure it out? Why can't Carrier IQ just tell us what its potential is?
Well, I think here the situation is, like I said, the Carrier IQ makes the tool, and it's from what I can tell, it's actually a pretty powerful tool. And it's really up to the carriers themselves, the phone companies, to decide what they use. Now, Carrier IQ has gone on record saying that, you know, that this is not a spying device, that it's listening for very specific information. I mean, you could think about certain keystrokes that might be hit when something's not working, and they're looking. So the software is looking for a programmed series of, you know, numeric sequences that would trigger some sort of diagnostic cue. And when it sees those, it will send out a message, you know, and it will transmit these diagnostics to the carrier, right? So there's the capability. And as far as Carrier IQ is concerned, this is a great thing because it provides better service. But really, when you think about, you know, what gets done with that data, it's entirely up to the carriers because they're going to decide, even if it's going to be collected, this information, they're going to decide how long it's stored, they're going to decide what they do with it. It looks like from the research, from what people have been looking at, that there's a somewhat less information that's being logged and potentially stored on the iPhone. It's geographic data and some other things, but probably not quite as much information as you might see on Android. And in fact, Apple has said that they will be purging this software from phones in future releases, although there's not a date on that yet.
So if they're purging the software, then how will they know when there's dropped calls and those kinds of customer service types of statistics they want to keep?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great question, and I'm not sure the answer to it. I mean, they still will have information about, say, you know, dropped calls. I think you can probably look along network traffic and see that. But, you know, it is a legitimate piece of software in that it does provide some real value and some real information. So that's what people are going to need to figure out. What I would say will most likely happen is, because this has all been brought to light, it's now going to become a matter of public record, mm-hmm. and everyone will be clear about it, and they will set some guidelines, and maybe, ideally, you'll have a third party that will be able to look at this and verify that information is not being saved, you know, collected and saved, that it's really being used for, you know, what it's intended. I think, you know, this is the kind of thing where shining a bright light on something is the best thing that could happen.
So, but it does exist now, and potentially most of us are not sophisticated enough to know how to figure it out on our iPhones or our iPads. And I guess the issue ultimately is it goes beyond transparency. It really goes to misuse.
Yeah, well, yes. And so it really goes to misuse. I would say because of all the attention that's being put on this, and there's going to be, you know, lots more research, there's going to be hearings, I think you'd have to be a pretty dumb carrier at this point to be trying to get a lot of information and use a lot of this at this point, knowing what is about to happen in terms of everyone looking at it. And again, I actually don't believe this is as nefarious as it's being made out to be. I do think there's the potential for something quite nefarious.
And you know, when you're talking about nefariousness, you know, it was installed on millions of devices over several years. The public was not informed, but you don't think you're thinking that the developers of it just didn't think it mattered?
I thought
it was a nifty thing, and
well, yeah,
you know.
I think the developers, I mean, even the name there tells you Carrier. They were trying to think about their customers, and their customers are the carriers. So Carrier IQ was something that gave them a tool, or a tool set at least, in order to do their business better. I don't think they were sitting around worrying about, you know, social implications and privacy and the like. You know, certainly as they were building this, no doubt it occurred to them that, you might be able to do something else with it. But, you know, in fact, their focus was very much on their customers. As developers, they were thinking about what these guys could really use, how they could do their jobs better. And there's millions and millions and millions of dollars at stake on being, you know, the best carrier, you know, being able to say, we have fewer dropped calls, we're faster, we have better service. I mean, we've all seen those ads. So this is not a trivial thing, and being able to provide that kind of service, if you can do it, you know, you can get a lot of customers out of it and make huge amounts of money. So I don't think that the carriers were particularly concerned with all the implications as well. You know, once this came to light, they're moving quickly to do something about it, mostly because, you know, no one wants to be in the spotlight for potential privacy violations.
But what about the potential, let's turn it, look at the other side of the coin, the good, could it be used sort of as like a high-tech bug?
Well, you know, much
for
of,
crime fighting, that kind
yeah,
of a thing?
Yeah, but I mean, but of course, you know, when we talk about implications here, there's all sorts of legal things. You know, as it is, the government has all kinds of, you know, backdoors, presumably, into carrier data, or at least, you know, rather data carried over the Internet, let's say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, plenty of civil, you know, folks concerned with civil liberties are worried about that as well. So there are guidelines on this and laws in place to govern this sort of thing. But we talk about not knowing what carrier IQ does. We absolutely don't know what the government's looking at in terms of looking for whether it's organized crime or terrorists or what have you. And we've also seen, you know, historically, this is a technology show, not a political show, but, you know, historically.
Oh, we do a little politics, too.
Yeah, we do a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, historically, we've seen that, you know, this kind of stuff can be misused. But so we don't really know how that works, but a lot of the technology is probably pretty similar in terms of, you know, some of this is very old. There's things called keyloggers, which is just a piece of software on a computer that literally logs and keeps a record of every keystroke you made. And, you know, there's a little of that built into Carrier IQ as well. That's those sort of capabilities.
I just think of like Mission Impossible and stuff like that.
Yes, but without those great masks you can put on that make you look like anyone else. That's the one I want in Mission Impossible. And when they get that, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to be Tom Cruise.
Another gadget for another day.
Yes.
Steve Fox, thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
Take care. Steve Fox, he's editorial director and VP at PC World. Coming up, we have Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The new film J. Edgar, directed by Clint Eastwood, portrays former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover as a man who had to keep his sexual orientation a secret, but collected other people's secrets to use against them. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the screenwriter Dustin Lance Black. He also wrote the screenplay for Milk about gay activist Harvey Milk. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher at 10 o'clock, Obesity, a Global Pandemic. And then in the second hour of All Sides tomorrow, a discussion of the future of NPR with NPR's new president and CEO, Gary Nell, along with the new NPR ombudsman. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher on Wednesday from 10 until noon.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Ohio Department of Health. The Ohio Medical Reserve Corps is looking for medical and non-medical volunteers who are ready to help Ohioans when disaster strikes. More details at ohioresponds.gov.
And just a reminder, this Friday, December 9th at 5 p.m., WOSU will no longer broadcast on 820 a.m. Tune to 89.7 FM to hear your favorite programs like All Sides with Ann Fisher and All Things Considered. You can also stream our service at WOSU.org. Listen to 89.7 FM. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Computer viruses, worms, Trojan horses, spyware, those are all common terms for the enemies we face on our computers but maybe can't see. Similar threats affect our mobile devices. Joining us today to talk about the latest developments in antivirus software for those gadgets is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Well, it's great to be back, Ann.
What's the difference between these kinds of threats to our computers and their cousins on our mobile devices?
In many ways, there's not. Okay. When it comes to smartphones, the trouble is that they really are just tiny computers, and we do a lot on those phones. You know, there's Bank of America applications for almost everything now. You know, we do our banking online. We do our email on these phones, and the concept of having antivirus software on these tiny computers really eludes a lot of people because, you know, it's just a phone.
All right. So someone asked, do we even need antivirus software anymore? Is it even relevant anymore? Why would somebody ask that?
Well, there is such a thing as people who can survive without antivirus software. It's not a requirement if you have very regimented browsing habits. You know, if you have, you know, very specific things that you do online every day and you don't, you know, stretch outside of that, you don't click erroneous links that get sent to you, you don't click pop-up ads, you don't have, you know, 13-year-olds that just got to have that Facebook, then, you know, viruses can be less of a problem, but that certainly doesn't mean that it's worth the risk of not having anything on there at all. There are definitely some things that, you know, you don't pay that yearly fee for that can provide, you know, just that little bit of peace of mind.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are the merits of the free versus paid antivirus software?
A lot of the free antivirus software, and really this goes for any kind of antivirus software, the antivirus software does you very little good if it's not receiving continuous updates. There are astronomical numbers that get rattled off as far as how many viruses are created every single day, and that number changes a lot, which is why I don't have it. But the amount of new viruses or spyware or, you know, whatever name they have taken for the task that they're given, they occur consistently. They're all the time, always being generated. And there are these companies that spend millions of dollars every year in research and detection and elimination. But if you only get an update, you know, once every 2 weeks or once every 3 weeks, then that's 3 weeks of every single day, every single hour, new viruses being created and spread on the internet that you can potentially be infected with.
So regardless of
paid or free, mm-hmm. The update cycle is what's important.
Okay. And with free, is it typical that there's not that kind of an update cycle? Or
correct. That's okay. What makes them inexpensive is that, you know, we're, you know, free in many cases is that, you know, it's the current commonly found things that get pushed, you know, to the device. And that does help with a significant amount of things, but it's certainly not a guarantee. Now, there is an exception to that rule that I found, and that is the antivirus software that Microsoft includes with everything now. They didn't before, but with Windows 7, the Microsoft Security Essentials Suite. Mm-hmm. Is something that's designed entirely by Microsoft. Microsoft has an entire team of people that do the research and detection and elimination, and that gets consistent updates, in many times, you know, daily updates that, you know, will help with detection and elimination. And that's something that if you have access to, it's definitely a good thing to have.
Yeah, we saw that antivirus software tops the list of the most popular free downloads. Is it good to try out something first in the free download before you actually buy it, or is that not necessarily an option?
So mobile devices, like I said, are kind of a different beast, and it's been proven on a number of different cases that the free applications that you get with antivirus software for mobile devices, be they, you know, Android or iPhone, they're mostly ineffective, and it's for the same reason. They get very few updates, and they end up not catching the things that are important.
I'm talking with Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Question or comment for Russell, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about antivirus software for all your gadgets. If you have a question or comment about that, get it in. Don't wait till the last minute. We already have two emails for Russell right now. If you want to email us again, allsides@wosu.org. And the email from Tom in Columbus says, I would like to know if using a cell phone or a laptop to order products from a secured website is safe. I know the website is safe, but is it possible for data to be compromised with the Wi-Fi connection? This is an encrypted Wi-Fi connection in my home, not a public source. Russell?
It's certainly a lot more difficult when you're looking at things that way. You have to look at it from the device perspective. If you're ordering something from the internet, from your phone, in your home with a secure connection, you stand a whole lot better chance of being safe than if you're sitting at a Starbucks, you know, with your phone and trying to do the same thing. However, the viruses that exist, the malware that exists for mobile devices specifically target things like capturing your keystrokes and, you know, tracking, you know, your browsing patterns and those kind of things. It doesn't really matter what kind of connection you have. If they have your password, they have your password. So it's important to keep in mind that, you know, the connection between your, you know, whatever you're surfing the internet with and the website is not the only point of failure. You know, you also have to make sure that there aren't things already on your computer recording that information and sending it off.
We have a tweet from Christina in Dublin. She asks, can you speak to why people say Macs don't get viruses?
Yes, I can speak to why people say Macs don't get viruses. So it is true that there are significantly less active viruses for Apple computers. However, they are definitely not invulnerable. And the reason that many people feel like Apple computers are safer are because of how things are. It's an architecture perspective. Most people who have Windows computers are the dominant account on the computer. They're the administrator. And they can reach in and do everything without the need for a password to verify the tasks that you're completing. And everything is very, you know, top down. You are the top of the tree for most Windows computers. And that's a bad way to do that because viruses can come in and act as the administrator because they're logged in as you and perform these tasks with impunity. Apple computers and Linux computers alike have a different architecture where you are the user in a list, but not the administrator. You're not the top of the tier. And so when a virus tries to do something, it still has to input a password. It still has to, you know, gain access to a higher level, to a higher function in order to do something. And a lot of people who use Apple computers in the default configuration don't allow that kind of access to happen. Now, that's one out of many, many different exploit methods that that viruses can use to infect your computer. It is the most common, which is why there are less active viruses on an Apple computer than there are on a Windows computer.
Does anyone ever get busted for setting loose a virus?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's busted, and it's, you know, there are definitely people who get caught. You know, especially when it's done locally. You know, when it's done within a small group. You know, there was a report probably 2 weeks ago of a person in San Francisco who was in a Starbucks and had a device that was recording, you know, packets as they were coming in, you know, across the Starbucks network and just gathering them. And you know, he was detected by another person who was, you know, using the network and contacted the police. So the police came and dealt with him. Hmm. And that's just another form of, you know, gaining that information. So, I mean, there are consequences for people who get caught.
Dick in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dick.
Thank you for having me. I have a cell phone. It is one that is intentionally not particularly competent. It has Windows access if I want to pay for it each time I use it, so I don't use it. I imagine this thing is essentially virus-free because there's no way for John Doe unless he has access into the carrier's network to get into this phone. Is that correct?
Correct. As long as, you know, the internet access is how things like that are maintained. So if the device doesn't connect to the internet for anything, then you're completely safe, or as completely safe as you can be.
There you go. Thank you.
Always the qualification. Thanks, Dick. Okay. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can tweet us at @AnnFisherWOSU. If you want to do that. An email from Kimberly in Columbus. She says, I have a Kindle Fire, and since I do browse the internet on it, I'd like to know about virus protection. Does the guest have a specific recommendation for Kindle Fire? Some of the antivirus apps in the Amazon App Store have been given bad reviews by Fire owners for locking up the device.
That's very true. And the Kindle Fire is an Android tablet. It runs a version of the Android operating system that's been heavily modified by Amazon to support their applications and make it a little more user-friendly than what you would find from most of those tablets. Keeping it safe is a little easier from Amazon's perspective because when I was talking earlier about the architecture for installing malware, there's a specific button that has to be pushed on the Kindle Fire in order to install applications that do not come from the Amazon market. The Amazon market is maintained and organized by the people at Amazon. They go through each one of the apps and they look and see what's coming out, and you know, they review all of those applications before the user can touch them. So those, for the most part, are safe. But when you have the ability to upload to download an application from the internet and in what's called sideload it, which is to install it using something other than the Amazon market, then you run into the risk of having, you know, malware and virus stuff put on your computer. If you don't know where that button is, you're probably safe. It's in your settings where it'll ask you if you want to install an application from an unknown source. And as long as that, you know, checkbox is not checked, then there's no way for something to be installed that didn't come from the Amazon market, which would be the most safe that device can be.
You wanted to compare Microsoft Security Essentials, which is the free Microsoft antivirus system, and Kaspersky Security, which is paid.
It's a funny name.
Yes, it is. It's fun to say, though, if you can. Kaspersky. Yes. What's the diff?
Well, the difference is, you know, the intensity to which updates are installed and things are scanned. One of the things that's truly impressive about the Kaspersky Labs for both mobile devices and for your phone is that it doesn't just, you know, a lot of antivirus software, you have a set time that you perform a scan, and, you know, every day at 2 o'clock, my computer does a virus scan, and updates come in at 6:30, and everything's timed and very, you know, orderly. Kaspersky is a continuous process. It's always scanning. It's always downloading updates. It's always functioning. It requires a lot of power. You know, when you have a computer that's a couple of years old, Kaspersky is going to slow your computer down a little bit. If you've got a newer computer, Kaspersky will continuously operate in the background. It doesn't slow you down any if you've got, you know, a newer computer. And it is, in my experience, I've tested a lot of antivirus softwares, and it is my favorite in terms of how easy it is to use and how complete in its security I feel.
As long as you have the power.
As long as you have a computer that can support it.
Greg, you're somewhere on the road. We appreciate you pulling over. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you. I have a question about antivirus software for people that have dial-up connections. Specifically, most of the antivirus programs are written, the files are huge. So when you go to download one of them, someone with a dial-up connection, it might take 2 days for them to download it. And I'm just wondering if there's a product out there that was written concisely for people with a dial-up connection.
I think you'll find that if you have a Windows computer, Microsoft Security Essentials is the most ideal for that situation for two reasons. The first is that it's already installed on your Windows machine, so there's very little that has to be downloaded, you know, with exception to updates, obviously. And the second thing that you have to keep in mind is while the antivirus software is difficult to download because it takes so long, so are the viruses.
I see. Okay. Well, And most of the programs I see, it's common now where it'll download a small file onto your computer, but that's not really the program. It uses that to actually download the program later.
Correct.
And that file is much bigger. Specifically, the one my father-in-law tried the other day, the first round was only about 3 megabytes, but the actual file was about 60 megabytes. So.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Greg. Thanks for listening.
Take care.
You too. We have just a few more minutes left with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We are talking about antivirus software. If you have any questions or comments for him, get the call in right away. We want to get your answers off to your questions. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Russell, what about behavior? What, for instance, are the best online shopping and banking practices? Some people suggest owning, for instance, a cheap second computer that you do only for shopping and banking online, so that you can keep things controlled and, you know, then unplug it when you're not using it and that sort of a thing. What about that kind of thing?
That certainly seems a little excessive, and as long as you're connected to a network with other devices, a lot of malware and viruses, one of the first things they do is scan your network to try and infect other devices. So it's kind of a moot point regardless. But what you really want to keep in mind when you're browsing is that, you know, read what you're, you know, what it is that you're clicking on. If something, you know, a lot of this, you know, is, for lack of a better, you know, describer, is common sense related. You know, if it's not something you're familiar with, if it's not something you know about, don't click on it. You know, if something pops up, be careful about where you're clicking. A lot of the pop-ups that happen, these really flashy pop-ups that, you know, have this thing that they're trying to sell you or trying to get you to click, they will have a false close button next to the close. So, I mean, you really have to pay attention when something pops up. You know, don't just click, you know, erratically to try and get rid of it, you know, because you'll more than likely click something accidentally, and that's how things go downhill. So it's really a case of paying attention. You know, when things come in your email, you know, simply opening an email is not usually enough to infect your computer. But all the same, read the title of the email before you open it. Don't just open every email that hits your inbox, and make sure that, you know, that the email comes from someone that you're familiar with.
We have an email from Josh. He says, going on the architect idea, does that mean if I always sign into my computer as a guest, I significantly lower my risk on getting a virus? And by the way, Russell, we're running out of time.
Yes. If you consistently sign in as a guest, then you do significantly lessen. But at the same time, for every kind of computer, if you create just a user with limited access and you log into the administrator account when you need to do something, you create that same barrier.
Okay. All right. Well, Russell Holley, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
It's been fun.
And any new ideas on Christmas gifts?
Oh, new ideas for Christmas gifts. If you're an Android user, actually today, there are, I don't know if this is Christmas gift, but something for yourself. There are 15 apps. Some of the top rated apps in the Android market today are only 10 cents.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Russell. And thanks to everybody for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.